Welcome into another edition of New Track Record. Caleb Hatch and Justin Kinney with you. Hello, Justin.
Hello, Mr. Hatch.
We finally made it to the end of the week and perhaps the end of the second Indianapolis Motor Speedway road course race. At least this race went out with some intrigue, if this was indeed the final edition of the second per year road course race, the Gallagher Grand Prix. Scott Dixon holds off a charging Graham Rahal in a race that had an exciting start, exciting finish, and a lot of tire strategy in between.
We should have known that with the race that Scott Dixon breaks the Ironman record of consecutive races started, that he would win.
And 319 consecutive starts, breaking Tony Kanaan's record. Also, a win now in what, 21 straight seasons? Is that right?
It's
19.
19, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah, because he didn't win in seasons. Was it 2004? Yeah, it was 2004. They had Ganassi had the boat anchor Toyota engines and did nothing. I mean, absolutely nothing. Back when we had, you know, 3+ engine manufacturers. But Scott Dixon gets the win. First win of the season. Now it's down to Will Power as far as will he get a win
for the end of the year. You got 3 shots left.
But we'll break that down coming up here in a bit. Plus, also, we got driver replacements. We have silly season news with Alex Palou. We have silly season rumors with Alex Palou. Plus, a handful of other drivers all to get to on this week's episode. Let's start with the Gallagher Grand Prix as Scott Dixon picked up the win last weekend at IMS, and we'll do our three things. I think first off, my first takeaway was, how in the world did Scott Dixon pull this off? He went from spinning on the first lap, involved in the contact that basically ruined Joseph Newgarden's day and ruining his championship hopes. Alex Palou hit his teammate Marcus Armstrong. Dixon went spinning. I think there's probably another driver involved that I'm forgetting, but Dixon spun. He took advantage of, you know, the yellow flags to top off and change tires and just went on a massive fuel save. But he kept moving up the order and cycling out of the lead with pit stops. And then suddenly there he is, the end of the race, final 15, 20 laps. He's the leader. I don't know how he pulled this off, but it's one of those only Scott Dixon and Mike Hull could pull this off kind of wins.
Well, it's how could he possibly have pulled it off? And then also, of course, he pulled it off. I think the biggest thing for Scott Dixon was that caution because it lasted so long. He was able to come in, top off, and then had 2 regular pit stops the rest of the day. So, A, he did spin, but he didn't have any damage to the car. And then, 2, the yellow was so long, he was able to conserve there and then conserve throughout the race enough to only have to pit 2 more times. So, of course, Scott Dixon was going to be able to pull this off because that's just what he does. And once again, just an impressive drive from him, not just in race form, but also being able to be as fast as he was and conserve like he was. And just a classic Scott Dixon type drive, starting 15th to first based on how the yellows fell, or the yellow fell, and being able to get the most in terms of fuel mileage out of the car.
And for Scott Dixon, this the IMS road course race in whatever iteration, whether in May or July or August or October, he's had so many good results, but yet to win. And now he's won at another track, essentially.
Should have known that it was coming eventually, but Scott Dixon gets it done, makes it now 19 straight seasons with at least 1 victory in IndyCar.
And Dixon leading laps, too, something that he really hadn't done much of in this event. 34 laps led, second most on the day, just behind Graham Rahal. But Scott Dixon, once again, I don't know how they did it, so I don't even know how to break down how this was done. It was so impressive that he pulled this off. But he was able to save fuel, save his tires, said he was shocked at how easy it was to save enough to do only 2 scheduled stops. Obviously, had the unscheduled stop after the lap 1 incident that caught him up in a spin. But He said he picked up about five or six spots. Then there was the backup. He got spun around. And then they decided to get the fuel mileage and just transition their strategy. But once again, at a track where it's been dominated by the pole sitter in this kind of race, only Scott Dixon could find a way to make it work from the mid-pack.
He's the only one seemingly to be able to do win races like this and gets another dub. And I think part of it was he wasn't the dominant car all day. So he didn't run a lot in front and have to burn fuel. That was Graham Rahal leading the most laps. So don't discount that aspect of things as well.
It's a good point. Let's get to your number one.
Well, let's talk about Graham Rahal. It was a good weekend. Being on the pole for the first time in 7 years and finishing second. I know he, of course, wished that he had gotten the win, but it wasn't a case of speed on Saturday or Friday in this sense, and then fading on Saturday. Graham Rahal led the most laps. He was there without the Herculean efforts of Scott Dixon and fuel save. Graham Rahal wins this race. Just another indication that this team is on the right track. And from going from the last time at Indy, not making the race, or at least not qualifying for the race before filling in for Stephen Wilson, going from that moment in qualifying to being on the pole in qualifying, quite the dichotomy in that. And it was good to see Graham have a successful weekend overall. It wasn't a bad qualifying effort, good race, or a good qualifying effort, bad race, just a good couple days all around for Rahal.
And I think the biggest thing is he had a weekend where he put it all together.
Correct. Wasn't one day or the other.
Yes.
It was an entire weekend.
Led practice one. Obviously, the pole was the dominant car in the race. Just Dixon's strategy. I mean, that's the only thing holding him back from a race win. Now, with this Rahal team, Christian Lundgaard, obviously, with a good result as well for Rahal coming in fourth. So he had back-to-back fourth place finishes, won the pole for the May edition of this race. So you look at Rahal, they're great on this track. They've shown well and shown better. It's just, can they do anything on the final oval of the year? Because that's where they've really, really struggled still on the season. Yes, there are less ovals, but they've really struggled on ovals, and that's kind of the one remaining box to check. I don't know if they can do that at Gateway. We'll see. But that's kind of the next step for this team. But, I mean, for Graham Rahal, obviously, on one hand, you have to feel disappointed because you had the best car. You had a great weekend. Everything was done to perfection. You come up just under a half a second short after, you know, taking what was a 6.9 second lead after his final pit stop and whittling it all the way down to just above 2/10 with two laps to go. And then at that point, I think was probably just the crossover point.
Yeah,
in the tires,
yep.
with the alternates, and Dixon just able to hang on. And also Dixon was saving fuel, so he saved his push to the pass. And then obviously used it in full effect the final handful of laps. Now, it was interesting to watch. So I was there on Saturday, and it was interesting to see, you know, we've talked about this to some extent. The drivers have obviously focused on it a lot as far as lap traffic and dealing with the leaders. It was interesting that Ryan Hunter-Reay, who is a friend of Graham's, held up Graham for, what, a lap and a half, two laps? And then Marcus Armstrong, who we thought would make it tough, moved over right away.
Right.
You know, how much of a factor did that play in this race playing out the way it did?
Lap traffic is always going to be a concern and an issue. You're just not getting rid of that. And nor should I think you should, nor should you. It's just an aspect of racing. But some people will say, well, Graham Rahal only had a couple more laps. He could have made it happen. Well, if there was a couple more laps in this race, Scott Dixon probably doesn't do the strategy he does anyway. So that's not really an argument at this point. But lap traffic is always a talking point. And Marcus Armstrong, we knew the incidents he's had this year. So for him to get out of the way, it wasn't necessarily surprising. But Ryan Hunter-Reay's out there pushing for position as well and trying to hold on to that lead lap. I have no problem with guys trying to stay on that lead lap. If a yellow comes out, you come around and you can make some moves and gain some positions. But if you're multiple laps down, should definitely get out the way, which is what Marcus Ericsson was, or Marcus Armstrong. He was already one lap down.
Yes.
And got out of the way
and
because
that was
he was going two
Hunter
laps
a
down.
Getting lapped. So correct. He was just trying to
so
protect.
I understand why. You don't want to go one lap down, but once you're down a lap and potentially going down multiple laps, you should get out of the way.
It's also interesting when you look at like manufacturers. I'm not saying that Hunter Ray did anything wrong, but Honda driver, good friend of Graham's. I was just surprised to see him hold Graham up for as long as he did in the latter stages of the race.
Hey, he's trying to stay on the lead
yeah,
lap.
Yeah, no, I get
him.
It. He's a competitor. It's yeah. just, it's one of those things that we've talked about at length, and no one seems to care when it's Ryan Hunter Ray, but they certainly care when it's a Benjamin yeah. Peterson.
Right?
Or someone like that.
Yeah, so it's just kind of weird.
It's interesting how that plays out. I'm not accusing anyone of anything. It's just an observation on how that went. Let's get to my
what's your number two?
Number two takeaway. Man, this is interesting. Let's talk Andretti.
Uh-huh.
This was a race where Kyle Kirkwood was able to move up. Colton Herta, disappointing qualifying. Romain Grosjean just fell way back, never had it. And this was a track where we thought after he had a pole, what, his rookie year, we thought if he's going to get a win, it would be on this track. That was the most likely thing.
Right.
And once again, after a good result at Nashville, he starts sixth, finished 18th. You had Devlin DeFrancesco, who started fifth, actually led the opening lap with an incredible pass.
I mean, you were there. You had boots on the ground to see
it
that.
It was shocking to see that play out the way it did. A great move, and then
faded per usual.
Faded very quickly. But for this Andretti team, we know they have the best street course package, right? That's pretty much undeniable with how Kyle Kirkwood looked at Nashville and Long Beach and how fast they've been, you know, at every street circuit, winning pole at Long Beach, pole at St. Pete. They've had speed at several other places. But the real concern here is, are they a one-trick pony as far as they're great on street circuits? But, I mean, they've raced at the IMS road course since 2020 nine times.
A lot.
Nine times since 2020. Just the road course. You got to remember in 2020 alone, they had three races there and then two every subsequent year. It's interesting to see teams, and it wasn't just Andretti, but teams that, you know, you would expect to be up there like Penske, and they were all pretty much mid-pack in qualifying. Ganassi, some of the Ganassi cars struggled. Dixon, mid-pack. Pillow, eighth. It's interesting to see how those teams kind of struggled. With a track with so much data and so many races, again, nine over the past 4 years, you would think it'd be pretty cut and dry. But for Andretti to just be all over the map, it's kind of puzzling. And I mean, Kyle Kirkwood's shown himself, but everyone else on this team, it's not hard to say they've underperformed this year.
It does need a revamp with this team when you look at it. Is outside of Kyle Kirkwood's two wins, nobody can do much of anything on this team.
In races. They have qualifying
speed. True, yeah. Well, where it counts. Races is where it counts. And
yes.
they can't execute in races. Same with McLaren. So that's just further proof of what we saw. And what happened was more of the same on Saturday for this team. And that's why I think you're going to see considerable changes, not just in the cars and the driver lineup, but I also think engineering as well with Andretti Autosport.
Well, and that's part where you got to figure it out, because at Indy, they were not, you know, really a contending team as far as qualifying. Kirkwood was up there late in the race, but that was about it as far as their drivers. So that's my number two. What's your number two?
Let's talk Linus Lundqvist. And for the second straight race, was very impressive. Qualified in the fast 12, finished 12th, didn't make an error to put it in the wall like he did at Nashville, but came out of the weekend once again, I think, impressing a lot of people, to the point that already rumors flying around that Linus Lundqvist could be a Ganassi driver next year.
A little crazy to me.
But, well, I'm not necessarily surprised, because this guy did dominate the ladder, and that's what was so egregious about him not getting a chance after winning the Indy Lights Championship, is just how good he was in Lights and before that. And he's making the most of his opportunity. And this is why I get frustrated when people say that Connor Daly never got a fair shake or whatever. This Linus Lundqvist has done in two races enough to open the eyes for Chip Ganassi Racing or a power team. That's all it takes, is a couple really impressive runs and opening a door potentially to a big ride. And Linus Lundqvist has taken advantage of it, kept it clean this past weekend. Didn't do that at Nashville, but impressed enough that weekend before putting it into the wall. But two races, that's all it's taken for Linus Lundqvist to really open the eyes of the paddock.
And we got to remember, we believe he has a deal for the final two races of the season, Portland and Laguna Seca. Now, my guess would be he has a deal with Rahal, perhaps. I don't know.
I mean, Daly, I would imagine that's the most likely one. Daly for Gateway. And then Lundqvist, the final two races. Could he be in as a factor for that Rahal seat? Maybe. But he's made the most of his opportunity, which is all we said. The kid needs an opportunity. He's finally gotten it, and he's made the most of it.
And fastest race lap, I believe, at Nashville, if I'm not mistaken. So a really good effort by him. In just two races, he's shown why everyone has been begging for him to get an IndyCar opportunity. And it's good to finally see that not only come to fruition, but him also live up to the hype. I mean, a fastest race lap in his debut, running quite well. You have to think losing the air scoop on a hot day in Nashville really impacted the crash late, and just rookie mistakes are going to happen. And then advance out of Q1, impressive. And then, you know, a solid performance, you know, above mid pack. I mean, you look at IndyCar and you used to think, oh, that top 10, not a big deal back when there are, you know, 17 to 22 cars, but when there are 28 cars out there, anything, you know, in the upper half of the field is pretty good with how tight and competitive things are.
Especially without the seat time that Linus Lundqvist has not gotten in IndyCar outside of a test here and there. So just an impressive performance once again from Lundqvist, and it's going to lead to him at this point having a full-time opportunity with somebody, maybe that somebody as good of a team as Chip Ganassi Racing next year. What's your number three?
My number three. I want to talk about just the event as a whole.
Oh, you stole my three. Okay, go ahead.
Okay.
No, go ahead.
I mean, I get that this was probably it as far as the IndyCar NASCAR doubleheader.
At least for now.
Weekend,
I mean,
at least for now.
If they alternate oval and road course, you could see it in every other year on the IndyCar schedule.
And I didn't see as much of a benefit in years past of IndyCar being second fiddle. And I get it. IndyCar fans don't like seeing that. I don't like seeing that, but it is what it is. That's the only way they could make, you know, these kind of weekends work. And it's just the simple fact that Penske owns the Speedway. So that's how they're able to do this. But the crowd up from last year.
Yeah.
They estimated, and I don't know what to believe, but they estimated 60,000, you know, on Saturday and about that on Sunday.
It's just such a cavernous
and
facility.
For,
who
you
knows?
Know, previously, it felt like, okay, IndyCar race, but there are a lot more people showing up toward the end of the IndyCar race and there for Xfinity. This year, it felt more like there are a lot of people leaving after the IndyCar race. Just
really?
Being like, you know, and I had to leave right after to head back up to Fort Wayne, but it just seemed like there were a lot of people only there to see the IndyCar race. And I found that interesting because it almost felt like the opposite before, where people were more there to see Xfinity on Saturday and the crowd was still kind of filing in in the latter stages. Anecdotal, I get it, but this event never kind of lived up to maybe the hype we thought it could turn into. And even with some NASCAR stars, you know, running Xfinity or IndyCar guys running Xfinity or even Cup, and, you know, the international flavor NASCAR got for this event this year with Jensen Button and Kamui Kobayashi and Shane Van Gisbergen and Brody Kostecki and, you know, guys like that. I mean, you had some intrigue, but it never to me felt like it lived up to the hype. Good weekend, like good event, good weekend. And I think it's definitely helped the NASCAR event, you know, move a little bit away from being on life support.
Uh-huh.
And they'll go back to the oval next year, and then people will all complain that the oval racing's boring. And then hopefully they'll rotate every other year. Does IndyCar need to be racing twice a season at the road course? No. But I will say having a decent event in what I expect to be the final second IMS road course race in a season was refreshing. It was refreshing to have some intrigue in an event that outside of a rain impact, whether it's in May or in August, has been pretty lackluster.
I've been vocal about not liking the second race for good reason. But what I do like about this weekend is having the series together in one place and it being an iconic locale like Indianapolis. I think it is beneficial to IndyCar to have the NASCAR guys there to see their product firsthand and the interest that can be drummed up. Who knows if Kyle Larson's any type of conversation with Kyle Larson over the last couple of years with McLaren or whoever started was an impetus or helped by this crossover weekend. Conversely, is the interest for Andretti going into NASCAR been bolstered by being able to watch Xfinity and Cup firsthand on a weekend like this? I think that's maybe something we gloss over, but I do think there's opportunity for both series racing with each other, at least with a weekend in which they intermingle and the relationships that can be built and grown and fostered or even introduced by a weekend like this. I understand the benefits. I know outwardly IndyCar fans mostly are sour about this weekend and me included in terms of the race, but I do think there's some benefit there. And 60,000 people, if that's an accurate number for Sunday,
that's bigger than
pretty damn good, right?
Every IndyCar race weekend except what? The Indy 500 in Long Beach?
Yeah, so Saturday.
As far as the race day crowd.
So Saturday getting that for IndyCar is good. Sunday, I think, for Cup is very good. You put 60,000 at the majority of races where Cup is, and that's a pretty damn good crowd.
Yeah, outside of Talladega and Daytona.
Right.
That's a draw. That's a really big crowd
it's
for Cup.
It's a really big crowd. Now, it's such a cavernous facility. It doesn't look good, but I would have to think that IMS would be happy with 60,000 in the stands next year for the Brickyard if it goes back to the Oval, I would imagine. So I think it was a successful weekend for both series and the track in that respect in terms of attendance. I don't like the event itself, but I understand how it and why it's been valuable. And it is maybe something I'll miss that going forward, IndyCar and NASCAR don't have a crossover weekend going forward. But I just, it grows stale with IndyCar being there. And I know people, it doesn't bother me as much as IndyCar being quote unquote second fiddle at the Speedway for a weekend. Doesn't really bother me as much as it does other people. But I do think there's some positives to take out of what this relationship has been over the last couple years at Indy.
Yes, I think it was now that we feel like it's nearing its end.
I think maybe you're more inclined to see the benefits.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree.
In the moment, it's definitely a negative. But looking back, there was, as you mentioned, some benefit. And I think that's good. I also think it's good, though, that they're hopefully going to not do this again next year and race at a different track. Because what does the series need? It needs more ovals. Hopefully what is happening.
And I think that there were a couple outlets talking about wanting to continue this somewhere else. Is that Iowa in some capacity? Is that Milwaukee at some capacity? Is it Watkins Glen in some capacity? Would IndyCar benefit from being a Saturday race at Watkins Glen feeding into Xfinity and Cup where they've gotten really good crowds of late at Watkins Glen? I think that'd be a benefit for IndyCar. So hopefully this relationship doesn't end with the road course going away on the Cup side.
And we pretty much fully expect NASCAR going on the oval because everything has been teased out. They obviously had the tire test this week. Even the renewal messaging, 30th anniversary, they're hyping that up. They have the car. It says come back around for the renewal and the car going, you know, in the oval direction.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious. They can't make it official because Cup hasn't released their schedule for next year yet.
But it's
happening.
A done deal.
Is it an alternating 2 days or 2 years? You know, oval road course. I don't think that's a terrible idea, but it'll definitely be on the oval next year.
Yes. So
is it my third?
Yes.
We still got to get to my third.
It's your third.
Felix Rosenquist got caught up in that first lap melee, finished last 17 laps down. What's the future for Felix Rosenquist? Is he in McLaren next year? Does he need a change of scenery? I think he's a guy that, if you talk about bad luck, has been bitten, in my opinion, by legitimate bad luck more than any driver over the last couple years. And once again, it reared its head for him on Saturday. And a guy that just sometimes I feel for, because when he's in a position to be an impact guy, more often than not, he just seems to get caught up in stuff. And Saturday was no exception. Do you feel like we're in a swan song over the final three races as the last three races that Felix is with McLaren? Or do you think him coming back next year?
You know, it's interesting. I feel like there are several options for him. We'll get more to this on Silly Season Talk a bit later on after we finish discussing the Gallagher GP. But most of the times his poor results are due to him being crashed, like Marcus Ericsson taking him out at Mid-Ohio, or equipment failures.
Right.
And McLaren otherwise is fairly reliable, but it seems like he's had a lot of reliability issues on right. his car, not just this year, but just over his tenure at McLaren.
That's why I think maybe he needs an influx of new voices, new
fresh start.
Environment, right? And it's dangerous to leave a team that you consider one of the top four in the series, regardless of not having any wins this year. But that can be a dangerous move. But if a Ray Hall seat, could he be a candidate for that seat?
One would think. Ray Hall, Andretti,
is he
Shank.
In McLaren's future with Alex Palou staying now at Ganassi, maybe. But who knows? It may behoove him to have a change of scenery.
It's a good word there.
Thank behoove. You.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's another key element of all of this. Some other notes as we finished our three things from this past weekend at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. This from Calhoun 98, Russ Thompson. Gallagher Grand Prix Saturday is only the sixth race in his career where Graham Rahal has led the most laps. He led two more than winner Scott Dixon. It was only the second time he led the most laps and didn't win the race. It shows you, I mean, this is stuff that only Dixon can pull off, right?
Yeah, yes. He's one of a kind in that respect.
And Tony DiZinno pointing this out, the 12th place finish for Linus Lundqvist, that's the best finish of the year for the 60 car.
How about that?
That's saying quite a bit for what he's accomplished. And Tony DiZinno also pointing this out, but for Chip Ganassi racing their top 10 streak through 14 of 17 races, Palou is top 10 all 14 races, Dixon 13 out of 14, Ericsson 12 out of 14, Armstrong 4 out of 10, Sato 2 out of 4. So in all 14 races, at least three quarters of the Ganassi cars have been in the top 10.
Pretty darn impressive, right?
And then Scott Dixon, it's mind-blowing, but Ryan Marine, the stat, and 382 IndyCar starts, Scott Dixon has been on the podium in 134 of them. That's 35.1%. So more than one out of three races, he's on the podium for every one out of three.
It's obvious that Scott Dixon isn't the Scott Dixon of even 3 years ago, but he is still, he loves to remind us in races like this that he's still one of the best, and you could say still one of the top five drivers in this series, even at his age.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, you look at, and I mean, Palou right now is number one.
Newgarden
probably number two, Dixon three. And then after that, I mean, you could argue several guys. I mean, you could put Pato in there. You could put McLaughlin. You could even put Kirkwood. Power.
Right. I think the first two are obvious. After yes. that, you can make a case for this, that, and the other. But just when you think, well, he's definitely fading, he has a performance like this.
Yes. It's absolutely just, it's showing what Dixon, he always finds a way. And even when we start to doubt him, he finds a way. Which race is more impressive? Portland 2018 when he drove through the dust cloud and emerged? Or his win on Saturday?
Portland, just because I still don't understand how he got through that without having any contact.
I agree. Another note, Kyle Busch got a two-seater ride over the weekend.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Do you think we see Kyle Busch at some point? Do you think maybe 2025?
I hope so.
That's
it,
why I
it
think
should have already, it should have happened for next year.
That's why I think Kyle Larson, maybe that seat would have been open. And we've read that about McLaren. It is maybe he could have been that guy if Kyle Larson wasn't. This is why I think these crossover weekends help. It keeps it in, in the consciousness of drivers like Kyle Larson before, and now Kyle Busch is being exposed to IndyCar directly, not watching it, hearing about it, blah, blah, blah. You're directly there. And I think that continues the itch for NASCAR drivers interested in running the Indianapolis 500 or IndyCar. And I think conversely, it helps on the other side with Michael Andretti and stuff being more and more immersed into the Cup side of things, looking, of course, to join that series in the near future.
Meanwhile, we talked Kyle Busch and Kyle Larson. They unveiled his livery, very similar to Scott Dixon's livery. So good luck to the spotters there. Same orange and blue colors with Hendrick Cars as the sponsor. He's done some simulator work, I believe, is at Mid-Ohio in the sim that he did. And the plan is for him to participate in the off-season test on the oval in October with Arrow McLaren.
Good to see.
Good to see the livery unveil is done. They even have shirts already up for sale.
Yeah, hitting the ground running.
Yeah, of course, you got to make sure you monetize all of those things as fast as possible. So now, his ROP, again, will be in October.
Yeah, which we see is that's going to be at Texas, or is it going to be at Indy?
At Indy.
But is it going to have a there was thrown around that maybe would have a test at Texas at some point.
Perhaps. I think we could maybe see that next year or later this offseason.
Yeah, early, but... Even in October in Indy, you never know what the weather's going to be.
Oh, that's true. So, I mean, early October is usually
okay. Yeah, you should
okay.
be good early October, but you know, hopefully that goes off without a hitch.
Yes. All right, so that's the fun stuff, talking about a race. Let's talk contract drama.
Man. Okay, what do we got?
So, first off, obviously everything around Alex Palou. So what happened over the race weekend, if you live under a rock, is that Zach Brown sent a letter around to McLaren team saying that Alex Palou will not be with the team in for the 2024 IndyCar season. Now, there are a lot of things, and Jennifer and I are breaking this story to AP, a lot of questions, you know, about, you know, how did this work? So Monaco increased management, which was Palou's management team, was they said that Palou didn't have any conversations with them, stopped taking their calls. MIM says they support McLaren. This is from Fryer. In a Wednesday call with Palou mentioned nothing of a change of plans. Confirmed McLaren also advanced Palou a portion of his 2024 salary. Remember, the heart of all of this from last summer was simply Palou was on a really cheap contract somewhere in the very low six figures, you know, $200,000, $300,000 a year. Back when he signed with Ganassi, he goes out, wins the championship in year one. He wanted a big increase in pay. Didn't get it. Scott Dixon obviously got it.
Mm-hmm.
It's said to be one of the, you know, between he and Herta, one of them, I'm not sure who, they're conflicting reports, but one of them is the best paid driver in the series. Palou wants that money. Now, he wasn't going to get Dixon money or Herta money, but he was probably going to get, you know, over $1 million, right? And Ganassi refused, and then that's why Palou approach McLaren, then you had everything that happened last summer.
Which I think I wouldn't be surprised if McLaren was ready to make him the highest paid driver in the series.
Oh, without a doubt, because McLaren is approached Dixon several times for that. Even offering, I think, an ownership stake was reported at one time.
Right, yes.
A couple
correct.
Years ago. So that's how this all came about. So Palou got a portion of the salary. Also, MIM says that Honda intervened to try to keep Palou. And could be promises of F1 development with Aston Martin once Honda becomes Aston's engine supplier. Again, though, a guess because communication has ceased as of Wednesday of last week. So that would be, let's see, August the what? The 9th is when communication ceased. This story broke over the race weekend, coming out basically late Friday night after... You know, after practice, after qualifying, boom, the story breaks, sends everyone into a frenzy. So much to take away here. I think that the first question that a lot of people have is, so if he couldn't sign with McLaren last year, how would he have a contract with McLaren that's already set for this year?
Well, who knows? I don't understand any of this, basically. But I think it comes down to, and we've brought it up before, is Alex Palou wants to be paid, but more importantly, or as important, is he wants to be at a place where he can win races and championships. And Chip had the ultimate comeback over the weekend that basically said as much. Alex Palou wants to be at a place where he can win races and championships. McLaren hasn't proven to be able to win championships, and this year can't even get wins. And so that's what it comes down to, is if the path to Formula One was basically closing for Alex Palou, which is what all indications are for next year, and maybe even beyond at this point, is the most important thing then becomes racing for wins and championships while being financially compensated as such. Maybe not mega money like McLaren was about to give him, but at least you're making several million dollars.
He's probably looking for something in the, you know,
two to three million range.
And McLaren was probably offering him mega money, like four, five, 6 million.
But if he looks at it and says, and we've said it before, if the path to Formula One involves continuing to dominate IndyCar, then he has to stay at a team that can do that, that can help him do that. McLaren's not that team.
No.
So whatever ends that McLaren has to Formula One, and they directly have more than Ganassi, doesn't matter if you cannot continue to prove that you deserve an F1 seat. And I don't think he can do that at McLaren. Alex Palou realized it. Has he gone about it the right way? Of course not. But the reasoning is sound, because McLaren, you could even say, has regressed in IndyCar over the last couple years.
And I think a big portion, we talked about this, I believe, on last week's episode, is just the changeover in management at the top. And there were several other, you know, executive types who are leaving the organization that came out several days ago. With Palou, I mean, he burned his bridge with McLaren forever on this, because he was going to be their F1 reserve driver on a full-time basis once the IndyCar season ended in September. In fact, he's already had several F1 testing sessions in a McLaren F1 car with the team. That's gone. So his pathway to Formula One is basically hope that AlphaTauri or Williams, which have been said to be the only teams interested in him, are still interested, because there is no path for him forward now with McLaren, and rightfully so. But he was at least on their radar. Now that's a no-go, as he no longer has that option. Now, I'm not going to pretend to understand contracts, but you mentioned with Chip Ganassi actually commenting publicly on this for the first time. He even said, "I don't make a habit of commenting on contract situations. Subsequently, I've been quiet since day one of this story, but now I feel I must respond. I grew up respecting the McLaren team and their success. The new management does not get my same respect."
Who knows if we'll ever know the same story. It's a he said, she said thing, or a he said, he said, Chip versus Zach type thing. And there's no love lost, obviously, between the two. This further deepens that divide. Zach's priority is to, across all motorsport for McLaren, is to put the best team possible together, no matter who he stomps on. And this time it backfired on him. And this time last year, it was McLaren saying all the kind of passive-aggressive stuff that Chip Ganassi is now saying. And now it's turned over around. So the biggest thing for Alex Palou is, and this is a question we posed on Twitter, is does this overall, this saga that never seems to end with Alex Palou, hurt his public image in the eyes of IndyCar fans? Is it becoming more difficult to root for Alex Palou because of this? Because we already have a fair amount of listeners that don't like Alex Palou because of the first time this has gone around. Now we're conversely going back again, and this whole thing are happening all over again, but the opposite way. And does this further harm him? Because if you go just by broadcast and he's a likable guy, right? But behind the scenes, he's just an absolute mess.
Marshall Pruitt compared him to James Harden, the NBA player who has been under contract and negotiated his way out of Brooklyn,
right,
out of Houston, and trying to do so out of Philly. And they finally just said, no,
right,
You're going to be at training camp. You're going to deal with it. Is that where we're at with Pelot? Like, Ganassi is a former racer, so he just wants guys that can win. All the other nonsense, as long as he can have a guy like Pelot on his team, he's going
to
deal with it.
But I think Zach Brown is exactly the same thing. He'll do whatever he has to do.
Well, Zach Brown was a former racer. Now, he didn't get to the levels of Chip Ganassi as far as in kart, but yes.
I think Zach and Chip, you put two alphas together and they're going to butt heads. And I think that's what you see because they have similar approaches. Zach maybe has deeper pockets than Chip Ganassi, far deeper pockets, but they both want the same thing. They want racers that win races and championships and will do anything they possibly can do to get there. Maybe Zach Brown is focusing too much on the McLaren IndyCar side on drivers and not as much the guys behind the drivers.
Yeah, the over-the-wall guys.
Yes. We've mentioned Taylor Kyle and how I believe that was the biggest single loss for any team in the offseason, driver or otherwise, going to Ganassi. So, but I think by and large, those two guys pretty similar in how they approach things, and that's why they butt heads so often.
Yes, and again, as far as we know, Ganassi picked up the option for Pelot, and that's why he's with Ganassi for this year. So even though Pelot had signed a contract with McLaren last year, the contract was invalid because he was still under contract with Ganassi. And Ganassi picked up the option. So that's how we got to 2023. Now, as far as getting the advance and all that, I mean, the drop-dead date was said to be September 1st. Now, we're obviously about 2 weeks away from that. So you're saying, well, how could he even have a future contract? And it's like, well, he had agreed. It was probably, we have this. The paperwork's all there. It's signed, but it's not official until September 1st. So my guess is that's how he got the advance. Now, obviously, you would expect another lawsuit from McLaren to get that money back.
This keeps going back and forth. It's just an absolute mess. And Alex Pelot needs to be better. He needs to have better representation or make better decisions behind the scenes. I don't blame him for wanting to stay Ganassi. I get it. I didn't blame him for chasing the money at McLaren. I get it. But it has to be handled better.
Yes. I will say this. His performance on track this year, it seemed to have a little bit of a blip on him last year after it came out.
Yeah.
He did win a race finally at the end of the year in dominant fashion. It seemed to get his confidence back this year, despite all this going on behind the scenes, which, of course, he thought he was set to go to McLaren and then somehow was able to not only change his mind, but renegotiate with Ganassi. And we presume he's going there.
Right.
He's been excellent on track.
Yes.
I don't know how, but he's been excellent.
He's pulled it off.
Absolutely. So that's obviously the first shoe to drop in silly season. And until everything is buttoned up and confirmed, look, we expect him to return to Ganassi next year. Now, it was said that Andretti offered stupid money to him for next year to Pelot. Obviously, we don't expect that to happen, but everyone was trying to get Pelot, right?
I mean, yes.
Why wouldn't you? He's one of the best drivers in the series.
Yeah, I totally get it, but man,
best driver in the series, but yet he's never won on an oval. Isn't that weird?
Isn't it wild?
Yeah, he did finish second in the Indy 500 in just a second year in IndyCar. So it's not that we don't believe he can win on it. It's just kind of funny that he could be a two-time championship winner in IndyCar and yet to win on an oval if he doesn't win at Gateway.
Pretty amazing.
Just kind of an amazing,
so
fun little stat.
So can you call him the best driver in the series?
Considering how he's run in the Indy 500, yes. I don't think we have any doubts.
If you are starting a team tomorrow in IndyCar, are you grabbing Alex Pelot? And I'm not, okay, let's take this all-encompassing, not just racing, but personality-wise, behind the scenes. Are you taking Alex Pelot or Joseph Newgarden?
Taking Joseph Newgarden only because you don't have all the drama.
Yeah. I would make a case that
Newgarden's just slightly older. So it's not like you're losing a ton of years. Like if you were given the option between, Dixon and Power and Pelot.
And I think quite honestly, Joseph Newgarden is the more well-rounded driver.
He's the most complete driver. Now he's had an incredible success this year on ovals. He's won every oval race this year, but he is still really good on every kind of discipline as far as road course, street course, oval.
If we're judging him by his entire body of work, he wins everywhere in all different kinds of circuits. We cannot say that yet about Alex Palou.
Just an interesting thing. Now, meanwhile, in other silly season news, well, we got some silly season news for 2023. Jack Harvey out, Connor Daly in the number 30 car at Rahal Letterman Lanigan Racing at Gateway. Not really a big surprise for Jack Harvey. I mean, it's been a struggle. Just one top 10 in his time at Rahal, and that was in Nashville. That's it. He was a driver who you thought was going to take that next step, moving from Meyer Shank to Rahal, and it never came together for whatever reason. But he was on a good trajectory until his time at Rahal. Yeah. And then last year was just a disaster, and this year was unfortunately for him more of the same.
What could have been if he stays?
Yeah.
Meyer Shank both ways, because Meyer Shank has struggled since Jack Harvey left.
That's true.
Who knows what could have been, but this was a move that seen a mile away. Nothing surprising in this. You're going to use the final three races to audition some guys. Connor Daly gets the start at Gateway just because of the experience, in my opinion.
Yeah, he's really good at Gateway. That's perhaps his best track.
I don't think he's a serious candidate for that seat.
No.
And then the final two races, do we see Linus Lundqvist there? Do we see two different drivers there?
I believe it's Linus Lundqvist, because that was rumored as far as him having a deal for the final two races of the year. I think it's for that, and I think that's where he will be. Now, will he be at Gateway? Will he be at Gateway with Meyer Shank? That obviously remains to be seen, right? Because they still haven't named a driver if Simon Pagenaud is not back, which is...
There's an interesting decision that Meyer Shank needs to make about that seat. If Simon doesn't come back, you can play the game that Simon was about to turn it around, but he was 24th in the standings when he went out. And maybe he doesn't turn around. But then you look at it as Tom Blomqvist, is he veteran enough to lead this team, or do you need another veteran? Do you get a rookie in there and go with Blomqvist and Lundqvist or whoever, or do you bring Simon back? You can't argue with the results or lack thereof of Simon Pagenaud. You can say that he was about to turn it around, but he was out of the leader circle when he exited the car, that exited that seat due to injury. So you can play that game and say Simon was about to do this, but the point of the matter is he didn't, and he hasn't been good in that seat. So what direction does Meyer Shank go to partner with Tom Blomqvist? I think it's going to be a fascinating storyline to watch. It would benefit Simon Pagenaud to get into that seat, back into that seat for one of the final two races, but safety is paramount.
Yeah, it's... That is one of those things. I mean, to me, there's no way they hire two rookies, right? I get that Blomqvist is older, but two IndyCar rookies would be shocking. Now, McLaren did that in 2020.
Right.
Now, Pato O'Ward, though, had significant race experience. I mean, Lundqvist at most, well, I guess, though, it's pretty similar. If Lundqvist runs Gateway and Laguna Seca and Portland, I mean, you're looking at what, five starts this year? Right. And Pato had like, I think, eight at that point.
Pretty
so
comparable.
Maybe that is the comparable thing.
While Blomqvist is a rookie in IndyCar, he's a veteran race car driver. So do you look at him as in terms of commanding the room, in terms of showing guidance to a youngster? He can do that. It just may not equate to direct IndyCar knowledge, right? So do you look at that as, yes, we're bringing in a veteran. He's a rookie in this series, but he's not a rookie race car driver per se at high level series.
Well, and having single seater, open wheel style experience.
Correct.
As far as Lundqvist. And then also we can't forget Elio back with Meyer Shank Racing for next year. He'll run the Indy 500, also joining as a minority partner. This makes sense. We had reported a while back that the Meyer Shank 2024 lineup would be Elio Castroneves, Indy 500 only. That works that he buys in. Think about Marco Andretti as his, part owner of his Indy 500 entry. We expect that to continue as long as he wants to do it. So Elio, Indy 500 only. Tom Blomqvist, full-time in 2024. And then we were told that it would be a current Ganassi driver. Now, Marcus Ericsson, Takuma Sato.
Marcus Ericsson's that leader.
But for all of that, I think it's interesting to see how this will all play out, because I simply don't know. I mean, everything was hinging on Pelot and assuming he goes back to Ganassi, which you can't really assume with that guy, right? It seems like the obvious move, but you can't assume.
As of right now, as of when we record, yes, that looks like it could change in 20 minutes. Who knows?
That's the issue there.
The problem is for them, for let's say Marcus Ericsson is on the radar, the lack of performance from that team is going to make other teams have a better position. You have to think Andretti, McLaren have a better chance at getting Marcus Ericsson. Mm-hmm. Then what's the desire to pick Meyer Shank over any of those, either of those two teams at this point?
And then in other silly season news, so Marshall Pruitt had an update on racer.com this week. So the Ganassi lineup for 2024, Scott Dixon, Alex Pelot, a Swede, but that's Linus Lundqvist, not Marcus Ericsson. As far as
sounds like Marcus lineup, Armstrong could be a full-time guy for them next year.
Yeah, that would just be financially dependent. So that's kind of where it's looking like now for Ericsson. Waiting for confirmation at Andretti Autosport. Pruitt says seems like a formality at this point. And then Marcus Armstrong, as you mentioned, likely to retain a seat at Ganassi. I mean, that makes sense. And then Lundqvist, MSR has an option for him, but they want a veteran with Tom Blomqvist. And again, Simon Pagenaud would be the obvious hope if he can come back and continue. But beyond that, that's where things kind of get up in the air. And then Felix Rosenqvist, as you mentioned earlier, you know, could he go somewhere else and be in a fresh start situation? There's a lot of interest, and if he doesn't stay at McLaren or move to Rahal in the 30 car, he also could be an option for Meyer Shank Racing. And then, you know, it just, to me, it seems like Rahal would be a great option for Rosenqvist if that's where he goes. And then David Malukas on the clock for announcing where he'll be heading next season. Other fascinating developments in the works is a trio of teams now talking about everything from joining forces to creating technical alliances. A number of teams and drivers in the next silly season installment. He did tease Juncos Hollinger and Callum Ilott with a potential technical alliance with McLaren for next year.
So much to still be decided in the silly season. Just when we start to think that everything is aligning and know what's going to happen, then everything gets thrown for a loop, and more often than not, it surrounds Alex Pelot.
And yes, it all starts and ends with Alex Pelot.
Yeah, pretty much.
That's how this always seems to work. So that's a look at the race, the drama with Pelot, and the latest on the silly season update in driver musical chairs. If you agree or disagree with us, let us know. You can find us at newtrackrecordpodcast.com. While you're there, sign up for the email list. It is free to subscribe. You'll get announcements for every episode and any other special announcements. We'll send emails out. Also, check out the store. We have t-shirts and stickers for sale for you. Also, you can find us on social media, IndyCar Podcast, the handle on Twitter or X, if that's what you call it. Also on Instagram, same handle. On Facebook, just search for New Track Record. You can email us, newtrackrecordpodcast@gmail.com. And you can always reach us on your favorite podcasting platform, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, Amazon, Overcast, CastBox, wherever you listen to podcasts, download and listen for free. And I'd like to thank our Patreon subscribers, patreon.com/newtrackrecord. Thanks to Xavier, Rob, and others for their support. Again, you can just chip in $1 a month and be a Patreon subscriber for us on there. All right, time for the mailbag, and a lot to get to in regards to the happenings over the last week or so, and that we had plenty of, and a lot of it regarding Alex Pelot. Jeremy from HPG saying Alex signs all contracts in disappearing ink. It's pretty like funny. As far as you posted a poll on Alex Pelot, and is it becoming tougher to root for him with the off-track drama and contract shenanigans? Nearly 58% of you said yes, 42% said no. Ton of votes in this one. Thanks to everyone for participating. Hickey93, people always quick to judge. Let the man do what he wants.
I mean, that's fair, but if you're signing contracts, it's not that easy.
And contracts do have to mean something. Yeah, and I get like, in IndyCar, we always joke, contracts can always be broken. But what we've seen play out with Pelot is why that level joke exists.
Like if you're getting paid from a team that you're joining already, you owe a certain amount of commitment to them, because they're showing you a financial commitment before you're even in the seat for them.
Jeremy from HBG saying, if Zach has given him money already, how does that fit into your equation? Contracts and even his own words seem not to matter to below. Isn't a great way to do business. Yeah, it's burning bridges. I don't disagree. Jay Lacey 16 says, right, he wanted to get to F1, saw that as his best chance. Don't know the conversation between Zach and him. Piastri wasn't settled, so it looked like he could have a seat. A lot of responses on this, obviously, because there's a lot to break down. Arcole, I don't mind it. Honestly, the series has been missing this kind of off-the-track drama for some time now. And the fact that this actually made some news sources outside of Racer and Indy Star is good for the sport.
I would agree. I think any drama is good drama. People always clamor for stuff like this, and then when it happens, a certain amount of people are like, oh, IndyCar doesn't need this, or oh, this is ridiculous. No, this is exactly what you want to pique people's interest.
Poet Shevchenko says, not tough to root for him, but I do have to ask, who is advising him how to go into business with teams? Because these gifts, I think, describe it well, and it's bridges getting blown up.
I feel like the ones advising him have now, he's either distanced himself from them or vice versa.
And is it him or is it the management teams?
Can't be the management team anymore because he's no longer with them.
True. JP underscore Orlowski 27. I really, really think he's a great and pure guy, but reading the article from Jenna Fryer, it made it seem like he kind of just got his initial payment and benefits from McLaren and then said, peace, Zach. I hope that's not the case, but an upside down smiley face.
It sure sounds like it, doesn't it?
Hunter's Way 67. I stopped rooting for the guy once he joined CGR. All the contract stuff last year just cemented it for me. The Roth said, can't be less than zero, so no. Gray underscore dog, no, totally not, but he might fumble the bag, LOL. And then Racing is My Life on Twitter said, to be honest, I think it's incredibly funny, and I kind of respect him more for making another silly season so entertaining. You know, on one
that
hand,
is true.
It's, you know, it's tremendous content. And that's what absolutely. We're here for at the end of the day.
He is delivering us plenty of content, and for that, we can be thankful.
All about that trim con. Gotta bring that stuff in. So that's thoughts on Pelot. Meanwhile, elsewhere on tweets and where things stand, let's get to rate the race. So where would you rate the race?
I had it as a 7. I think it had some early season or early race drama, some late race drama. Middle was kind of eh. And one of the better races that we've had in the spring or the fall at Indianapolis. So I give it a 7. What about you?
I'm going to go 7.5, just slightly better.
Had a unique perspective. You were there.
Yeah, I was there. I think the middle portion was uneventful, tire strategy, fuel. But the beginning and the end did just enough to move the needle up a little bit. Jeremy from HBG gave it most of the races a 6. End of the race, about a 9. Good stuff. Yeah, exactly. Poet Shevchenko, I don't think a race with a spin and win could be lower than a 7, but what is the score really? Started with an unusual top 6. The RLL cars held the lead well. They also had the greats of the series working to the front. Battle at the end of drivers hungry for a win, gave it a 9. Big D Kart gave it a 7. I know folks like to crap on the Indy road course, but it was a fine strategic race. Hunter's Way 67. Graham chasing Dixon at the end was exciting. If Grand Ray Hall had his sticker reds, maybe he catches them. Huge turnaround for him in RLL since May. Audi F1 engines, laps 1 through 70, solid 5. Final fight for P1 bumps it up to a 7. Yeah, it's fair. Daniel SCM 2004 gave it a 6. Good race, but typical of a race of the Indy road course. I'm Analog, gave it a 6. Race sounded more entertaining than it looked. P Gaynor 14 gave it a 9. Love a good strategy call. Jimmy B 44140 gave it an 8. Run underscore mark underscore run gave it a 9. Clean race, great strategies. Just needed one more pass at the end to get a 10. Yeah, I think that would have changed everyone's outlook, right?
I would agree, but I am firmly in the camp that there was no way that Scott Dixon was going to let Graham Rahal pass him.
True. They were going to either crash
or Scott Dixon was going to win.
Christos, about a 6, typical Indy road course lately, not very exciting, more of the fuel tire strategy. And we also had an email submission as well. This from Brad, 8.0 masterclass by Scott Dixon, fun rooting for RLL. Yeah, the crowd was really behind Graham Rahal, and obviously so.
They rarely have had the opportunity to be firmly behind him in a good position to win a race.
Not since, what, 2021 Indy.
Right. Yeah.
It's been a bit. In 2020, the crowd wasn't there, and he had one of the three best cars in the field.
Yep.
So that's a look where things stand on Rate the Race. As far as the TV rating, we didn't talk about this, but Gallagher GP 0.3 rating, 556,000 viewers. Remember, it's on USA. It was up against Titans Bears, as Arcole points out. But again, the last time this race was on cable had 502,000 viewers, that from Poet Shevchenko. So between Road America and Mid-Ohio, as far as it was in the middle, as far as USA races, going to be behind Mid-Ohio just because of the NASCAR lead-in, or at least non-lead-in with Chicago.
Yeah.
500,000 for a cable race, I'll take it.
Yeah, it's all right.
I think that's pretty good. So that wraps up the mailbag for this week. News and notes time, and the racer mailbag had a couple interesting notes. First off, Marshall on Milwaukee says they're trying, but I haven't heard about anything being done for 2024. Again, schedule usually comes out a month from now, so there's still time. So that was interesting. And then as far as interest, so on the mailbag, and this comes after the silly season, or after or before the silly season article?
It was before.
Before. Okay, yes. So Ericsson on the way to Andretti. This is not a surprise. And then McLaren, again, I mentioned that linkage with Callum Ilott, which I find fascinating because I think Canapino, in my opinion, has been more impressive this year.
But at least based on preseason expectations.
Yes, maybe. And maybe that's what it is. I don't know. I don't understand. There's a lot of hype with Ilott, but I want to see the results delivered.
At least some runs that exceed expectations, which I don't think we've seen enough of them, particularly this year.
No. Meanwhile, Scott Dixon wanted Shane Van Gisbergen to give IndyCar a try. That didn't quite work out.
Nope, now he's on the fast track to full-time cup ride.
He will be a cup driver next year. Elsewhere on, so Connor Daly, as far as the number of teams, so he will have driven for three different teams in a season two times in 5 years. In 2019, he was with Andretti, Carlin, and Aero McLaren. And then this year with Carpenter, Meyer Shank, and Ray Hall. Then you throw in Foyt, Coyne, Harding, and so many other teams. Nine different teams in his career.
The master sub of this era.
Yes. He has become that driver. Jay Fry posted a tweet. I believe this is at Sebring, but Will Power and Scott Dixon testing the hybrid units for 2024. I had heard some scuttlebutt that there's potential of things getting delayed yet again. And I think it was largely due to parts issues.
Well, that was the reason why it was moved back a year.
Yeah. So let's hope that that continues to progress forward. Also, this really, really cool. And there's a video, but a throwback livery for Colton Herta at Laguna Seca in the season finale. So if you recall, Colton got his dad's 1998 race winning car back when he actually drove for Ray Hall. At the time, it was a Shell sponsored car. It was black, white, and then yellow for the colors. And that was a gift, you know, back in May. Well, then Andretti decided to do a throwback livery, and it'll be Gamebridge, the sponsorship, but it is pretty close. And I mean, you have the color scheme to work, Gamebridge, yellow and black, and obviously you can add some white on the car. This is a really cool looking car. You can check out the video on Andretti Autosport's social media. And proving once again that IndyCar desperately, desperately needs a throwback race.
You don't necessarily need the sponsors of old to pull off a throwback race. And that's, I don't know if IndyCar understands that.
And it's funny that We Are the Race actually talking about that on social media as far as a throwback race. And this just seems like a great option to do it. I hope it can happen. I mean, the car looks great. It's a really cool thing. They have crew shirts already made up for it for you to buy.
All ready to go.
I mean, the drivers are on board. Scott McLaughlin is saying yes, yes, yes on Twitter as far as wanting this to happen. But man, I'm begging IndyCar, please find a way to make this work.
Yeah. Quit making it this hard. Shouldn't be.
this should absolutely happen. And this, maybe this livery, maybe this is the beginning of that as far as making this work.
Let's hope.
I hope so. Other notes to get to before we wrap things up on the show for this week. So we talked about the livery, and I guess it's just time for tweets of the week. So Tony DeZinno, Pelot, meanwhile, in P7, posts his second worst finish of the year. P8 is his worst. He's got more contractual dramas than finishes outside the top 10.
Oh, man.
And then David Malukas, Malukas David on Twitter. If you caught Bus Bros, you'll get this joke. If not, you won't. But he tweeted, no way the man that was shirtless, thirst trapping on 100 days to Indy, referring to Newgarden, mm-hmm. is calling me an F-boy. That was when they were doing their interview on the Nashville streets on Broadway.
Yeah, yeah.
Pretty funny. And then Indy 44 with this, waiting for this TV series announcement. And he's got a picture of Alex Pelot in the middle, Chip Ganassi on the left, Zach Brown on the right, with a caption, 100 days to the courthouse.
Seriously feels like that.
It certainly does. All right. Oy. Random split error driver of the week.
Well, time. We thought we had exhausted our early IRL days of random split error drivers of the week, but
not possible.
Not possible, because we have one and you have the information. I found it and brought it up on the screen. So you have the information from the inaugural season of the Indy Racing League.
Rick DeLorto. I have never heard of him.
Uh-huh.
This is crazy. So in 96, DeLorto Motorsports driving a Lola T92, which would mean that's a pretty old chassis. Buick engine, did not qualify at Walt Disney World, the season opener. And that was it.
The series opener, even.
Yeah. He attempted to race in two kart championship races in the fall of 82 during the split with USAC at the Milwaukee Mile and Road America. Failed to make the field in either of those races either. He made seven starts in the Formula Super V Robert Bosch Valvoline Championship in 85 and 86. Two American IndyCar Series races in 89 he made starts in. And then he tried in the IRL. Again, four-year-old Buick car, Lola chassis. Didn't complete his driver's test. Not allowed to qualify.
He had a four-year-old car.
But the best thing is, he still earned $10,000 for his entry.
How about that? They were just throwing money around in the early IRL days. That's amazing. Could you imagine somebody showing up right now, four-year-old Buick powered or a Buick engine in a Lola chassis, and just didn't have what it took to qualify, even attempt to qualify at Walt
Disney World. Can't imagine. So that was it. He was active in high-level amateur SCCA racing as of 2006.
You know, what's interesting, too, is that 1996 season, he was 47 years old. So this is not a young cat either.
This is like Buddy Lazier a few years ago, you know, in the Indy 500 when he was right. 47, 48 years old.
Yeah, still waiting for that Flynn Lazier entry.
Right? Yeah, where's that at?
But yeah, one and done. Didn't even appear in a single race in the IRL, but we found a hidden gem in the inaugural season of the Indy Racing League. So Rick DeLorto, this week's random split era driver of the week.
For Justin Kinney, I am Caleb Hatch. We'll be back next week to talk all things IndyCar. I'm sure we'll have more silly season nuggets. Plus, I think we can maybe expand on this whole throwback race and make it happen. A lot of people with some ideas for Milwaukee or Gateway going back to a night race. I think we have some good options here.
Yeah, we'll expand on those ideas.
And I think we can look at some options for the teams, too. I think all of this is some good content for next week. So we'll try to get to that next week, unless all craziness breaks loose on silly season.
Very possible.
Which, yes, absolutely could happen. So for Justin Kinney, I'm Caleb Hatch. Thanks for joining us on another edition of New Track Record Podcast.
Podcasts by Federated Media.